Good morning. You are tuned into KRFY, that's 88.5, Panhandle Community Radio, and this is the KRFY Morning Show with your hosts, Jack, and drumroll please, Jim Healy is back.
He's back.
Yeah. And welcome back once again to the North Idaho Panhandle, Mr. Healy.
Oh, Jack, it is absolutely great to be back. I mean, when I unlocked the door downstairs, mm-hmm. I left it open. The weather is incredible.
Especially, I imagine, coming from the Midwest right now.
Let me tell you, I was mm-hmm. with my mother for mm-hmm. a month, and we had 3 weeks of where the temperatures, the high was around 10 degrees, overnight lows minus, mm-hmm. and finally this past week, I was finally able to get her out and about simply. But yes, I would call friends back here, and they'd go, neener, 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 we're having nice weather. Of course, they weren't skiers, mind you.
No.
Skiers are still not happy.
No, skiers are not happy out here. That I don't think we had any. I think in the period you've been gone, we've had no 10-degree days, I would say.
But We have a guest in the studio.
We sure do.
And then I will introduce him, and then mm-hmm. we'll do some of our weather and that sort of thing. But Bill mm-hmm. Collier, local veteran and author of a book, The Adventures of a Helicopter Pilot Flying the H-34 Helicopter in Vietnam for the United States Marine Corps. Captain Bill Collier.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, Jim and Jack. Thank you for inviting me.
It's good to see you, buddy, and we're just going to talk about your book in this hour between here and 9 o'clock, and we'll go on until we run out of things to talk about. But, Jack, what's the day going to be like, buddy?
Well, it's, Jim, what you missed while you were gone was...
Oh, what I miss? What I miss?
It was almost summertime. I mean, it was nothing but sunshine for what seems like about a month. I mean, just... It was very sunny, but now we are getting into the rainy March weather. But the high, 57 today and 60 tomorrow, looks like we'll have a mix of sun and rain throughout the weekend, with highs up in the 50s and getting up towards 60, particularly tomorrow and then again on Sunday. It smells like spring out there, doesn't it?
And you know about what March rain does.
Brings April flowers.
There we go. Yeah. We have garlic up about 4 inches in our garden. I guess that's common. I guess everybody who does that, you plant mm-hmm. garlic in the fall, and it's up. And it's so healing to see something green, mm-hmm. fresh popping up.
I saw some bugs yesterday.
Go away.
Which is less healing. And
well, when I was back in South Bend, we have mountain ash trees in our backyard, and we mm-hmm. know that. The harbinger of spring are the robins that come and get drunk on those little berries. And my partner sent me pictures mm-hmm. of and a little video of the racket.
Drunken birds. Mm-hmm.
They must get tipsy, Bill. I mean, here are these berries, these mountain ash berries, and they're sitting there. And if they're like all berries, after a while, they ferment, don't they?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I don't know. Maybe there is someone out there in the listening world who knows if the robins get drunk on mountain ash berries. But they make a heck of a noise.
It sounds like something that could happen. I bet they do get drunk. That's, yeah, as you said, like all berries, they will eventually ferment. But we could talk about robins all day, but we've got bird note at 9 o'clock to cover that.
And maybe they will answer that question.
Yeah.
I think we should turn to our guest.
Agreed.
Captain Will. Isn't that your email, Captain Wilco?
Captain Wilco, yeah, Gmail.
There you go.
it was a natural because my name being William Collier, Wilco is an abbreviation that they used in World War II for when pilots were talking to each other, they'd say, Roger Wilco, over and out.
Roger mm-hmm. Wilco, over and out. Well, we have Captain Wilco, and we're not going to let him over and out until we're done with him. Mm-hmm. Bill has written a book, and it's an incredible read, and I had the opportunity. When you're with a 102-year-old person, you have lots of time to read, and that's what I was doing, and I was reading Bill's book, and Bill, this is an incredible book about your experiences in Vietnam. From what years?
Mid-1966 until mid-1967.
What was the war at that time? Was that peak years, or was it still gearing up?
It was still gearing up. It really didn't peak until the Tet Offensive of 68. So I just missed that, luckily.
Okay.
You got really nasty at that point.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of nasty things in your book that you mention. Here you are, how many years after that experience? Why write a book now as opposed to 20 years before or never write a book? What was the impetus behind writing the book?
Well, first, let me answer the first question. It took me 25 years to write the book. I started writing, putting stuff down on paper in 1990.
Okay.
And I would work on it for a while, and then I would have to put it away for a while because it would stir up too many bad memories. And then I would think about it for a while, and by then the technology would have changed, and I'd almost have to start over, or I'd lose my notes and start over and then find my notes again and have to compile the two. Mm-hmm. It was very, very confusing. And basically, I just grew up in a family of storytellers. Okay. I grew up before television. So up until the third grade, we didn't have television. And I lived next door to my grandparents. So the uncles would come over, my uncles and my father and my older brother and grandpa would all sit around playing pinochle and cribbage, swapping lies. And every story started off with, there I was in Paris, Texas in 1923, and I was driving a 1918 Graham Page. Or I probably have the numbers right on the car, wrong on the car. But there was always a place, a time, and whatever car they were driving. And that sort of format just sort of stuck in my mind. Whenever I tell a story, I have to say the time, the place, and whatever I was flying at the time. And,
Now, not every veteran writes or wants to write or take notes about their experiences. Why do you? Okay, you're a family of storytellers. Who's your audience?
I have a huge audience, actually. You know, there are in this county alone 19 veterans organizations.
No kidding.
There are 19 just in Bonner County.
Go away.
There are. Wow. Some of them are only two or three members. But there are.
But still.
And some of them are like the Vietnam vets here in town. We have over 100 members.
Wow.
And we encourage people to come join. Small plug for VVA there.
Okay. Well, we can talk and give contact info and things like that. Why do you feel that there are so many veterans organizations? Veterans are a unique group of individuals. Coming back, is that, you know, that their experiences wherever they were stationed and whatever they did made it such a unique experience that they want that camaraderie and fellowship that they don't find?
Oh, absolutely. Veterans enjoy talking to other veterans because lots of times if I start telling people things that I've done, I see them kind of wander off mentally, and I know what they're thinking is that this guy is so full of it that there's no way he could have done what he said he did.
And then you get it together with a group of other veterans. They go, well, let me tell you.
And then we match story for story, and we know the validity of each other's stories. So, because we know the times and the places and why there are so many organizations, I don't know. It's just each group comes back, and they meet with some guys, and they say, oh, let's form an organization. And first thing you know, there's another new veterans organization, so.
Okay, you were in Vietnam, 1966, 67. What were you doing over there? Just for someone who might not be familiar with the book, essentially, what were you doing there?
Well, I was flying helicopters for the Marine Corps, and I've been trained to fly the H-34. And for those people who have seen the 4th of July parade here in Sandpoint, the old derelict H-34 that goes through town on the 4th of July parade, that is an H-34, and that is my project also, through the Vietnam vets, and it also is going to be in the Lawson 50s parade and the car show. It's not a car, but it's a 57, so it qualifies.
It's a mode of transportation. You know, one can move from point A to point B with it, so it does have a place in the 50s weekend.
And that was my job in Vietnam, was just to fly those things around and support the troops in the field. So if you think of Sandpoint City Park as being a home base, and there might be a battalion of Marines spread all over Sunnyside Peninsula out there.
Okay.
And they might be spread out into three or four different positions. So after they've been out a few days, they're getting low on food. They're getting low on water. We'd like to bring them mail. They might need some ammunition, so we might load up four smaller loads and hop out there. It might take only 5 minutes to get there. Land in the first place, give those guys some food and water, hop over to the next place, give those guys food and water and mail. And once in a while, we'd slip in a little beer for the troops,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And then hop over to the third and or the fourth place. And each place we landed, if they had someone who was sick or injured or wounded, we would bring that person back to the hospital, too.
How did you find yourself in Vietnam? Did you volunteer? Or you draftee? Or?
I volunteered to... I was recruited. And that's basically being volunteered. I was going to college in Napa, California, Napa Community College, it's now called. It was then Napa Junior College. And this recruiter on the quad, dressed in a spiffy green uniform, was showing pictures of a mock-up of a cockpit of an airplane. And I wasn't really interested in being a pilot, but I was interested in being an officer.
Hmm.
And when this captain told me that when I finished flight school, I could be a second lieutenant, I jumped at it.
Okay.
I want to be a second lieutenant, man. This is the way to go. This is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the afterglow of World War II, and anybody who'd ever been in military was a hero. And I just wanted to do my share. And my father mm-hmm. had been in the Navy at the end of World War II. My brother had spent some time in the Air Force, and I wanted to do my share, as they say. And so I joined up before Vietnam. And so Vietnam started happening while I was in flight school.
Mm. And you mentioned several times in your book that you didn't go to boot camp.
I did not.
How did you not? I thought everybody went to boot camp.
All my friends are always appalled when they find out I never went to boot camp and I never went to officers training and I came out as a captain of Marines.
It sounds like a catch 22.
It's a W.E.B. Griffith story. It really is.
Well, how did you not? You know, were there other fellow veterans, fellow soldiers who did not go to boot camp?
Many, actually, really? Yeah. The Navy and Marine Corps had a special deal from 1957 till 1972. If you had 2 years of college and you could jump through all the hoops and pass all the tests, you could go directly and immediately to Navy flight school in Pensacola. So that's what happened to me. I went directly into flight school. Now, we had a little 10-day mini boot camp in at the beginning of that. But it was nothing compared to what the guys talked about regular boot camp.
Well, what then is the purpose of boot camp? If certain people were designated as not going to boot camp at a 10-day mini boot camp, what did you not need that the other people needed? You're smiling.
That's a hard question. But I think the main reason is we were highly motivated volunteers. We volunteered to do this. We wanted to do it. We had a goal in mind. We knew when we finished the process, we were going to be naval aviators and get our golden wings. And that's a big goal.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, like the carrot in front of the donkey, we're just going for the carrot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned you didn't get into it. You had no real desire to be a pilot at first.
At first.
Yeah. But did you know that you wanted to fly helicopters once you started, or did you want to fly planes, or... What was your goal?
I really think that I didn't have a goal at that time. I just wanted to finish flight school, and mm-hmm. it never occurred to me that I would become a helicopter pilot. But as we went through the process, it became obvious that there was somehow the government could see in its infinite wisdom that there was going to be a tremendous need for helicopter pilots. And probably 85% of all the classes went into helicopters at that time. A few guys went to jets, and maybe one guy in 100 might go to transports.
Well, essentially, Vietnam was a ground war.
Oh, it was.
And it wasn't necessarily an air war. And so helicopters are definitely needed. Now, when you initially you talk about being a medvac, evacuating the different levels, I wrote them down, routine, priority, and emergency, and then you end that section with about guys just wanting to go on R&R and calling up. We have an emergency here. And all they wanted to do was to get back to base so they could go on R&R. Did you have a choice of the kind? I'm sure there were different kinds of helicopter pilots. Ones who were there different kinds? Not everyone was in the field, were they? Were some moving cargo back and forth? Or
we had about 10 different basic missions,
okay.
And it was just a rotation basis. One day you hauled cargo, one day you did admin, one day you did recon, one day you did medevac, one day you did resupply.
Okay.
And it was just whatever your turn was that day, and the scheduling kept track of that somehow, the operations people.
And what were you best at? You talk about the different maneuvers of a helicopter pilot in there. And if you had to say your reputation as a helicopter pilot rested on my ability to...
All of the above. I mean, we just were there. We just did everything we had to do every day. And I don't think there was any particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we got pretty darn good at going into hot zones when the bullets were flying and somehow dodging between the bullets. And I'm not sure how I was so lucky.
I was going
to
ask
to not
about
get hit.
That. Yeah.
God was looking out for me, I suppose.
Did you have any? Well, you did receive a Purple Heart.
Yes, I did.
For the stone underneath the toenail.
Yes. My Purple Heart was a joke, and I tried to refuse it, and I was disallowed my disapproval, or whatever you want to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're here on 88.5 KRFY talking with Bill Collier, author of Adventures of a Helicopter Pilot. And Bill, you said that you had been writing this for years. You'd say you started, what, about 1990?
January of 1990 was when I first put pen to paper.
So 20 years this has been gestating, and how did you find the process? Did you find your memory? Now, I noticed that you did a lot of research, you know, finding out from other, helicopter journals and things like that, when the actual flights and the different things that you did, the hours. How did you find your memory? Looking back upon, because if you wrote it began writing it in 1990, you were about 20 plus years away from the experiences.
Right.
So how did you, as you began putting it down on the paper and getting it out of yourself and then looking at it, what did you think? I mean, did you go, wow, that doesn't really exactly catch the essence of it all? Or what were you remembering?
Well, I had three very good factors that helped me remember things. Every other year, we have a reunion in all different parts of the country. It travels around. And I get together with a couple of thousand of my best friends, and we swap lies. And this reinforces all the memories. And they may be exaggerated and embellished over the years, but the memories are still there, and the basic nut of the stories are still there. And a lot of guys bring pictures and videos. And there's a tremendous website. It's called P-O-P-A-S-M-O-K-E, Pop A Smoke, all one word. .com.
One more time.
Pop A Smoke.
P-O-P A Smoke. S-M-O-K-E .com.
.org, actually.
.org.
Sorry.
And it's a website for?
All Marine Corps helicopter pilots and crew. And there are thousands of pictures and stories and events. They're explained. Almost everyone who was killed, someone witnessed it, so they've written that story on that site. And it's a tremendous source. And the one where I wrote, a couple of things I wrote, I got from that. And mm-hmm. some of the pictures, the one picture of the burnt up H-34 came from that site with permission.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took hundreds of pictures while I was in Vietnam. So I have all those pictures to fall back on. And every one I look at, you know, they say a picture's worth 1,000 words. Well, I have 300,000 words just mm-hmm. in my picture file.
Mm-hmm. And you included quite a few of them in the book.
I did. There's more than 100 pictures and illustrations in my book, and almost all of them came from my own personal resources, files.
And you had, you didn't have to sneak your camera in. You were
very much allowed to carry cameras. There was never any hesitation or dictation that we couldn't.
I'm just fascinated by the ability to process your experiences. So between when you exited the military and 1990, you were just simply, how were those memories working for you?
Well, you know, there's an old psychological thing that says if when you're in danger, you kick into the fight or flight mode. And I lived in the fight or flight mode. Oh, thank you. I could not take any kind of confrontation, any kind of disagreement, or any kind of threat or frightening situation. I would flee.
Mm-hmm.
I quit jobs. I left relationships. I moved god-awful number of times during my 27 years after Vietnam because it was either kill this person or flee this person.
Mm-hmm.
There was no in-between for me, and I couldn't kill anybody. I was not. I wasn't trained in boot camp how to kill, so I didn't know how.
Your 10-day mini camp.
I just learned how to salute and stand at attention and sleep at attention at mini boot camp, but I didn't learn to kill. If I had been through boot camp, it might have been a wholly different, because you hear a lot of stories about veterans who are overly aggressive, and they get agitated, and they flare up very easily. Mm-hmm. It's all called post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. It really is. And there are enormous numbers of veterans out there suffering from post-traumatic stress. And I was one of them. I had this situation where I couldn't handle anything. I went through 80 jobs. I moved 50 times. Rough numbers that I wrote to a journal. And I went through relationships like most guys change oil in their car. I just mm-hmm. couldn't take any stress whatsoever. And I survived by going out in the woods and taking these very remote helicopter jobs in Alaska or Saudi Arabia or the South Pacific or Tennessee mm-hmm. and basically hiding out. I fortunately had a skill that allowed me to go to these places and hide out and make a living while I was doing it.
Hmm. I was going to comment that before we went on the air, you were talking about PTS and the post-traumatic stress. And you strike me as a calm. Your voice is really just level. You have a wonderful demeanor. You're social. You enjoy being yourself and talking about your experience. You weren't always this way, were you?
Oh, absolutely not. And it's a long story that got me here, but to put in a plug, I just love Sandpoint. It's so peaceful and quiet and friendly here. I don't ever want to go anywhere else for long term. Just love it here.
Okay.
The people are just wonderful. Going to the post office for me has become a social event. Just walking down the street, I run into people I know. I love it.
It's a good feel. Here's what, this might be a good time to take a break, and then we can come back and talk about post-traumatic stress, and because there are people who are returning now to the States who are trying to deal with it. I queued up a song having read Captain Bill's book, and it combines two of his loves, and three, the Beach Boys, California, and girls. And that's got to be a Grand Slam home run. So let's do California Girls.
Yay.
And we'll regroup, and we'll come back with Captain Bill Collier here on 88.5 KRFY, The Morning Show with Jack and Jim.
Ha.
The KRFY Morning Show is broadcast every Tuesday and Thursday, live at 8 a.m. Tune in to 88.5 or stream us live from our website at 8 o'clock to hear the complete and unedited program, including musical selections. Due to our licensing, we are unable to include full songs in our downloadable podcasts. We now return to the KRFY Morning Show.
This is the KRFY Morning Show, and that was the Beach Boys. California Girls, the name of that song, which was from 1965, and that one, just the intro to that song, I think Brian Wilson said it was the best thing he ever wrote was that introduction.
That introduction.
Just that sort of orchestral guitar.
It's sweet,
sound.
Isn't
yeah.
it? It's
yes,
sweet.
It
just, you know, it's just sort of like a wave. It just brings you right.
It takes me right into summer. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're here with, go ahead.
Perfect on the sun, bringing us into summer.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We're here with Captain Bill Collier, a local veteran, and we're talking about his book, Adventures of a Helicopter Pilot. And where can one get that, William?
That book is available at Vanderford's.
That's where I got my copy.
The Corner mm-hmm. Bookstore at First and Main.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Fiddlin' Red's Music Store on Church across from Joe's.
Okay.
And
the Bonner Keoki. County Library.
And the library has two copies.
And okay. And Keoki.
The high school library has a copy.
Wonderful.
For the high school kids.
Oh, good.
And at the Surplus Store on Fifth.
Cool. Cool. We left before we went to California Girls talking about post-traumatic stress. And one of the things that struck me reading your book was here you are coming from Napa region of California, somewhat civilized, a way of living. And then you get over to Vietnam, and what you write about, the day-to-day, you mentioned earlier, you wonder how you ever missed all those bullets, or walking along and incoming missiles, and the death, bringing wounded soldiers and dead soldiers up out of the field. You go through that, and then it ends, and you come back to the States, if you're lucky enough to come back to the States, and then you're supposed to function like all the people who've never been over there. What was it like returning, and how was it to find the kind of Bill Collier that needed to go on without, you know, do you see what I'm getting at?
It was a tough transition, but basically I managed to sort of blank it all out with alcohol because it became habit in Vietnam to just, because we were pilots, we went back to a base every night, so we would just go to the bar every night after work. Mm-hmm. And sometimes drink ourselves silly. Mm-hmm. And that carried over. And it, I guess it worked well for me because I didn't have a whole lot of trouble readapting to the States, except that once I got out of the service, then I had trouble adapting. But I didn't have the traumatic thing where I was disrespected for being a veteran, because almost immediately after getting out of the service, I took a job that took me overseas and kept me out of all of that hassle. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get that spitting in my face or disrespect or whatever that a lot of guys say they experienced.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's almost a sequel in the works here.
Oh, there is a sequel in the works. Yeah. Yes, there is.
The adventures.
When I got out, I did not want to go back to the war because of the horror of it. But things were grim in 1968. The airlines were furloughing and there were no jobs. I wanted to fly after not being even, I had never seen the inside of an airplane when I went to flight school, but when I got out of the service, I wanted to be a lifelong pilot. No jobs. So I got an application and I went to work for the CIA flying in Laos on the other side of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And that is the subject of my sequel. We'll get to more into that at another time. But that was high adventure. That was the greatest adventure ever. But coming back with post-traumatic stress, I had trouble adapting. And even after the CIA experience, I still had some trouble adapting. But I think I was luckier than most guys. A lot of guys, especially the infantry, who've been out there and duked it out hand-to-hand with the enemy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I saved lives. I didn't have to kill anybody. I didn't really see firsthand too many of my friends get killed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for the average veteran coming back who's been out in the field, it's hard. Because you go from, sometimes, yes, from right out in the field shooting people, like 3 days later, you can be on the street in Los Angeles or San Diego or Chicago or somewhere. And suddenly the most trivial thing, someone wants to get in your face over something that's so trivial that it doesn't matter. Like if you get a job and the boss says, oh, you flipped that burger wrong or you didn't dot that I on that report.
Boom, it triggers.
What you want to say is, you know, take that report and put it where the sun don't shine because mm-hmm. it doesn't matter. It's not important. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys, that's why we have a lot of veterans in this area. And I really am want to reach out here to those guys who are living out in the woods. They don't want anything to do with society. They come to town once or twice a week or maybe once a month, maybe twice a year to get supplies, and they go back out in the woods because they've been so traumatized they don't want to talk to anybody, they don't want to see anybody, and they don't want any confrontations. That's the scary part. We have a lot of those guys, especially in this neighborhood.
And a lot of them are returning every day, given the situation in the Middle East, which I'm quite sure that you are seeing firsthand with returning veterans of all ages.
I am.
So what do you suggest? How can people who do not share the experience that veterans do, how can they help to make the reentry a better process, if one can say that?
Well, if nothing else, the fellows just need to feel respected. Mm-hmm. And if nothing else, if you see a veteran, just reach out, shake his hand, and say, welcome home, mm-hmm. and mean it. And if you want to add to that, you can say, thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Because that means so much to us, because especially the Vietnam vets, but the Iraqi guys and the Afghani guys too.
Yeah, you're talking about the Vietnam vets, and you know, when you stop and think, a lot of your experiences are going on 50 years, and in the category of, like, when you were growing up and I were growing up, World War II veterans. And
yes.
And now we're getting a whole new generation of returning veterans
we
from
are.
The Middle East.
And they're just not getting the support that they need from the VA at all. It's really sad, but, you know, there are 22 veteran suicides every day.
Wow.
Every day, 22 veterans kill themselves. A lot of them, a majority of them, Vietnam vets who have just finally reached their limit and they don't want to go on anymore.
If there is a veteran listening, or a family member of a veteran, what would be a way to get in contact to plug that person into the system?
Chad Osborne is the County Veterans Service Officer in the counting building at Highway 2 and Division.
Okay.
Right now, I think he's out for some surgery or something, mm-hmm. but he'll be back soon. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's someone at his number who can connect you. But if anybody feels like they've been touched by this presentation and they think, well, you know, maybe Captain Collier was a little right, I could use some help, call Chad Osborne's office. And I'm sorry, I don't have the number right offhand, but he can connect you with somebody. And
well,
I still, Jim, go to therapy once a month.
You do?
In Coeur d'Alene.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a guy named Dante, I forget his last name, but he has a group weekly here in town, and I go to that when I can.
Okay.
I go to that one because I want the younger vets are coming to that one.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll go and we'll sit in a circle, and they'll sit back with their arms crossed, and they won't say anything. So when the leader of the group asks a question, I will answer it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'll see a little glimmer of light across the circle, and one of the other guys will say, oh, yeah, I had a similar experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll start to talk.
Mm-hmm.
Draw these guys out. I feel like I'm being a mentor at this point for the younger fellows.
Well,
and that's why I go.
I'm quite sure that you can see yourself in them. And then they're sitting there and here's somebody with gray hair, a gray beard, and he isn't armed or ready to jump at every car that's backfiring and seems to be okay. And absolutely, that somebody can, as best as one can, make that readjustment.
Yeah, the weekly meeting is run through the Veterans Service Office in Spokane Valley. So if someone, again, I don't know that number, I should have come better prepared, but Dante Ramore is the group leader.
I do have a number up here. Chad Osborne he's been a guest on the morning show in the past.
Good.
And we have if you go to our website, krfy.org, I'm sure you can find his podcast, just search for Chad Osborne, but also his the number for the Veterans Service Office here in Bonner County is 255-5291. You can also reach him via email, cosborn, OSBORN, at bonnercountyid.gov.
Yay, thank you.
Yeah, of course. The Veterans Service, which is, I think it's run, it is not directly affiliated with the veteran, with the VA.
That's a county office.
Yeah, it's a county office. So he's a local veteran, and these are all local veterans.
Yeah, he's a retired gunnery sergeant.
Yeah.
If anybody is in the whole world is going to get anything done, is a former gunnery sergeant.
Why is that?
They just know how to
get the stuff ins and outs and get the stuff done. Okay, excellent. How long after your exit from the military did you continue to fly a helicopter?
I continued to fly until early 1996.
Okay.
I was the senior pilot for the Orange County Fire Department in Southern California,
mm-hmm.
flying the Super Huey,
mm-hmm.
and it was great fun. It was adrenaline rush. It was like combat. I'd go
you
out there with my
adrenaline.
Go out there with my helicopter and pick up a load of water and go kill that darn red communist stinking jerk of a fire, you know.
tell me, I'd be sort of curious that I'm quite sure that there is a new generation or several generations of helicopters out there, the kind of helicopters that they're using in the Middle East and other hot spots. Have you been in any of them? I'm sure technology-wise, the use of computers.
It's like the difference between a Model T and a current-day Lincoln. It really is. I mean, they are so incredibly slick and are all turbine-powered. I flew the reciprocal engine where we had to control the throttle manually, like a motorcycle throttle.
Got it, yeah.
So it was difficult, challenging to fly, because every change one thing, you had to change everything.
Everything else.
Mm-hmm. And it was like dancing. It really was dancing in the sky.
There's a photo on the cover of your book. Speaking of that, talk about precision. This is not a visual medium, but it looks like you're putting down, a fellow pilot is putting down a helicopter on a landing pad that is
a postage stamp.
Yeah,
and it's elevated.
Yes, up above some. Was
this a karst, a geographical word for a piece of limestone that sticks up like that? Is called a karst. K-A-R-S-T. And there's one in northern part of Vietnam called the Rock Pile. Mm-hmm. And the Marines had a detachment of Marines up there for an observation post so they could watch what was going on around that valley. Well, they needed resupply. It was extremely difficult to climb up. I don't know that anybody ever did. Probably the initial people to go there were lifted in by helicopter. I'm almost sure of that. So we would have to go in and resupply these guys. They needed water. They needed food. They got their mail, and we'd bring them a beer occasionally. And they had sick and wounded and people who needed to go on R&R, the whole litany of everything that we did. And we'd bring replacement troops in and out. And when I first got there, that wooden platform that you see on the cover was not there.
Okay.
The whole landing strip was about 5 by 20 feet. And we'd have to hover in and plant our wheels crossways on the slight landing strip, and then hover with our tail floating out over the
abyss.
But
never totally land.
But we could never totally reduce power because we would just fall over backwards.
Boom.
Wow.
And we had to adjust when someone got on. We had to add a little power so we wouldn't fall over backwards.
I remember you writing about
that. And if someone got off, we had to reduce power a little bit so we wouldn't lift off. It was very challenging. And this is a lot of the excitement and fun of flying helicopters. It was just very, very challenging and exciting to do these things. We trained and trained, and by the time we got to Vietnam and was landing on this thing, it was just routine. Like the astronauts, they train so much that when they're blast off, their heart rate is lower than a man in traffic.
Mm-hmm. They've done that before. You talk about the adrenaline rush of it all.
Yeah.
And
they live for that after year after year.
Is there anything else you'd like to... I mean, I have a final question I want to ask you, but is there anything else, Bill, you want to say about your book and your experiences?
Well, I also want to stress that it wasn't all blood and guts and gore. We also had a lot of fun. It was very challenging. It was very exciting. I lived in a large tent with seven other guys, and we became very, very good friends. And there were probably six other tents with as many guys. And over the year, I bonded with those guys to the point where some of them are still my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
When I got married to my current wife 10 years ago, one of them was my best man. And I'm sad to say, one of them just died in January. I was on my way to visit him, and I didn't quite get there in time. Mm-hmm. But the kind of guys that we actually say, I love you, to each other, that's how strong our bond is. You don't see many guys saying, I love you, to each other.
No, you don't. We're here with Captain Bill Collier, author of Adventures of a Helicopter Pilot. And my final question is on the back cover, there's a picture of Bill after he has just completed Navy flight school in mid-December 65, so almost 50 years ago. And I look at the guy, and clean-shaven.
Short hair.
Short, dark hair. And there he is. The look on his face is interesting. It's introspective, pensive, looking out there. When you look at that picture, Bill, what do you see? You know, that here you are 50 years later. What would you tell that guy?
Go to Canada. No, I wouldn't do that. But
I mean, how did you get from that guy to who you are now?
It's a long story.
I know. Okay, well,
boy, is that long story.
We'll have other interviews here, but I encourage anybody who gets a copy of the book to look at the back cover. And one more time, Bill, let's run through where the book can be purchased.
All right. The book can be found at Vanderford's, the Corner Bookstore at First in Maine, Fiddlin' Red's Bookstore on Church, right across from Joe's. the Surplus Store on 5th, and Keoki Press, just catty corner from the post office. And me, if you see me on the street, just stop me. I usually have one with me. So.
And when you see Bill on the street, go up to him. I'm sure he wouldn't mind. Give him a hug and thank him for the good job that he's done and the good job that he is continuing to do with I think, focusing on veterans, because I know that you are very active in, I don't remember the name, it's not Shout Down, but it ends with down.
Oh, the Stand...
Stand Down?
Stand Down.
Yeah.
Has been canceled. There is no Stand Down this year.
Okay, but you do a lot of good efforts by trying to connect other veterans with other veterans.
Yes.
And we here in the community cannot thank you enough.
Thank you, John. It's lovely to hear that. But I'm heavily involved with the Vietnam Vets of America and the Marine Corps League. Mm-hmm. Also a member of the American Legion and a couple of other things that I don't really participate in. I've only have so much time. But, yeah, veterans helping veterans is what we're all about. And we're constantly doing something to help veterans.
And what's extremely, what I find so admirable about you is that you're visible, that one can see you at different events. One can see you functioning in the community as a veteran who is proud and who has returned.
Thank you.
Good job.
Yeah. Well, yeah. When we get a chance, I'd like to finish off with the fact that my book is also a love story.
There could be somebody out there listening.
It could be. In 1963,
yeah.
I came back from Alaska, mm-hmm. where I quit mm-hmm. a job doing helicopter logging because it was, in my mind, unsafe. And it turns out the company went out of business, so I didn't get paid. So I came back really, really broke. But somehow I met this delightful young lady who, even though she was a high-powered executive with a high-powered tech company, could see past my dysfunction and my brokenness and sort of adopted me and helped me look at my stuff. Mm-hmm. And she didn't do it just by saying, Bill, you're all messed up, you need help, because that would have sent me off into the next county right away. But she very carefully and very gently, very lovingly asked me funny little questions like, how did I feel about that? When I told her a story about something in Vietnam or
right.
when I quit my job, she says, how did you feel about that? And feelings, I write in my book, I don't got to show you no stinking feelings. I don't got no stinking feelings.
They're dead. I don't deal with them.
But she did it in such a gentle, careful, loving, wonderful way that I actually thought about it and said, oh, feelings, what are those? Mm-hmm. And how do I access them? And then to make a long story short, she helped me to access my feelings. And eventually I got into the County Veterans Service Officer in Sonoma County, California. I got into group therapy. I met with a bunch of nice group of guys for months, years even. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had contact last night from my leader of that group.
Oh, how wonderful.
And that led on. I actually spent 6 months in the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress in Menlo Park, California, next to Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. A psych hospital, okay? You want to call me wacko? Call me wacko. But I admit it, and I'm proud of it. I got some help. You guys out there listening, if you are afraid of getting help, don't be afraid. It feels good. So anyway, 6 months later, I came out of the hospital almost reborn, almost the Christian kind of thing, reborn. I just had a whole new perspective and a whole new outlook on life. I got a really good job. In 8 years, I was able to earn enough money to retire to Sandpoint. And here I am. And it was that one little bit of love from this wonderful woman who is now my wife, Carla. I hope she's listening. Mm-hmm. And
that noise with his lips, Carla. He wasn't clicking his fingers or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And she made such a tremendous difference in my life, and she still does every day. Love her dearly.
So sort of like that T-shirt that you see around town here that says Life is Good.
Yes, I like that. Can I buy one of those?
Excellent, excellent. Mm-hmm. Bill Collier, thank you so much for coming on the KRFY Warning Show.
You've been warned.
And keep us posted on any activities, garage sales that the veterans are doing. We'd love to have you back on.
The Marine Corps League is having a garage sale sometime in May.
Okay. Okay.
At the storage containers across from the high school. We've had, this will be our third year, so it's pretty well known. We'll have lots of signs up.
And it'll be on the calendar events, and we'll read it.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, and you have a great day. Enjoy it. We're going to make a transition to the number one song 50 years ago on this date.
Oh, really?
Yes. Of course, it's a Beatles song called 8 Days a Week. It's a song that later on, after the Beatles broke up and John Lennon became sour with Paul McCartney, he called the song lousy. And but the interesting thing about this song is that this is the first song that the Beatles went into the studio with it unfinished. And in the sessions, they worked on the final version of it, which is a process that they did more and more. So eventually the Beatles became not a live band, but a studio band. And they never performed the song live. Here it is. It's one of those conundrum song titles that I sort of like. It doesn't make sense. It's called 8 Days a Week. I thought they only had seven. Here's the Beatles. 50 years ago today on March 12th, 1965, the number one song, The Beatles with 8 Days a Week.
The KRFY Morning Show is available as a free download at krfy.org. You can also stream Panhandle Community Radio live from the website and find program schedules and more information about the station. While browsing krfy.org, support the station by clicking the Donate button on the right side of your screen and help keep Panhandle Community Radio commercial-free and a growing community resource.
The Beatles. There you go. That's the Beatles with another lousy song. Thank you, John Lennon, for letting it. I like it, quite honestly. It's upbeat. It's got a memorable lyric, and I'm glad that they wrote it, contrary to what John Lennon thought.
He's, I like 8 Days a Week. It's a pretty good one. I don't know why he would call that lousy.
Oh, I think part of the reaction to the Beatles breaking up and blaming Paul McCartney, and then of course discounting all of his co-authorship over the years. But that was the number one song, March 12th, 1965.
Jim, before we get into the events calendar, I have a question for you.
Oh no, is it going to hurt?
No. Who's your favorite Beatle?
Oh.
That, impossible.
That, you know, I didn't have a favorite Beatle. I had a favorite Beatles. There were moments of brilliance when they separated, but I think the whole is greater than the parts. Together, they created incredible music for such a short period of time, and when you look at their music catalog. But individually, you can look at John Lennon's Imagine. You can look at George Harrison's My Sweet Lord. You can look at so many Paul McCartney. But somehow, they brought the best out in each other.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite?
I don't. No, I would agree with that. That they were at their best when they were working together. I think a lot of people say that John Lennon was... Or not a lot of people, but there is sometimes certain members of the Beatles get a bad rap or something that they were, you know, that the best Beatles songs were Lennon songs or something like that. I don't necessarily think that's true. And I think I think it's better when they were really writing together.
Well, it was a creative process. I'm sure a give and take back and forth. You look even at a song like Here Comes the Sun or something that's attributed to George Harrison. I'm quite sure the entire group, when they got together to work on it, I think the three double CD sets.
Whoa,
what happened? Ooh, I recognize that intro if no one else does. That is REM, Losing My Religion.
That's right.
That came out in 1991 on this date. But real quickly, I think the Beatles, the way in which they worked in the studio, listen to the three double CD Chronicles CDs, where it's a collection of as they worked towards their finished product. How, you know, you'll hear, they didn't even have the words, they just had the melody. And it's fascinating to see the creative process. But what gets me is that it was so intense and so consistently wonderful for just, 7 years. Of course, a lot of people say that you cannot discount the years that they spent in Germany and Hamburg, where they really honed their craft, playing other people's songs.
Right. Yeah, the formative years where they were really...
Absolutely. So when they finally do make it, they're pros. They don't have to work through very much. And but they were great sponges. They absorbed so many different music genres and styles. And I think, you know, that Lennon was the moody one. He had the more serious... Paul McCartney comes out of the British music hall tradition, you know, obla-di, obla-da, you know, Desmond and Molly and the Marketplace, you know, that sort of thing. I could talk about the Beatles forever. All I know is that I am so thankful. They have been a major part of the soundtrack of my life. I never get tired of hearing a Beatles song.
No. Yeah, they are pretty great. I was never a Beatle maniac, I guess, but you have to... respect. I mean,
can I say something, Chad?
Until lately, I guess. But go ahead.
Can I say something?
Go ahead.
How old were you when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan?
I think we've asked that negative 20 years.
To have been alive when they were, you know, certainly. And I don't know how it would be to pick them up after now 50% of them have passed, to pick them up after they have a whole catalog of their own music. You know, apart from one another, I don't know.
It is different. And you also, I mean, when you hear the Beatles as a, after the fact, when you hear them for the first time, not in the '60s, when you hear them after the fact, you can say, well, sure, I like that song, but I like this one by the Rolling Stones better. But you don't necessarily realize that, yeah, but the Beatles did it first. You know, I mean, like, the Beatles were there, and for seven, just such a short amount of time, the musical ground that they covered. Where this is the Beatles Hour with Jack and Jim.
I could go on forever. Coming up this weekend at the Hartwood Center, William Shakespeare's Macbeth. And it says here, performed as you've never seen it before. Friday, March 13th. Saturday, March 14th at 7:30 p.m. The Hartwood Center is over at 615 Oak Street. The doors will open at 7, and you can watch. Here's a bit of trivia. This is Shakespeare's shortest play.
I didn't know that.
That's something in terms of number of lines. Tickets are available in advance at Eve's Leaves or at the door. And if you want more information, call 946-6174. Shakespeare's Macbeth at the Hartwood Center, March 13th and March 14th.
That's one I wish I was going to. It does look like what I've got on my screen here is that there are going to be some serious special effects. Michael Bigley's adaptation of Macbeth presented by the Unknown Locals here. That's the Unknown Locals.
And you can find them on Facebook.
Yeah, that's right. I wish I was going. I'm not. I think I'm going to be in Missoula on Friday night and Saturday night, but
I work the Panada Theater on Friday night.
Yeah.
And I think you have the blurb on the Panada Theater on the documentary called National Gallery.
National Gallery is at the Panada Theater this Friday night and Saturday night. The film goes inside one of the greatest museums of the world, which is the National Gallery in London. That is not our National Gallery. The film screening times are 7:30 p.m. Friday and 1:30 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. again on Saturday. Sponsored by the Panada's Global Cinema Cafe. You can learn more on the Sandpoint Movies page. Oh, somebody's calling the radio station. And
hey, we have a listener.
I know. Yeah, thanks.
Yay! Woo-hoo!
Thanks for listening out there. You can visit panada.org for more information about that. Also coming up next week and this weekend, tonight there is a free movie screening at Monarch Mountain Coffee of Dryland. This is a movie about a small agriculture town struggling to survive, beginning at 7 p.m. tonight, March 12th, followed by a Q&A with the directors. Admission is free, but a donation of canned food for the Bonner Community Food Bank is greatly appreciated. Sponsored by Monarch Mountain Coffee and Winter Ridge Natural Foods. We are darn near out of time. What else catches your eye there, Jim? Was there anything?
Well, catching my eye is next week on the morning show. Tuesday is, and I'll do Thursday.
Okay. Tuesday is. Chris and Susie will be up here and interviewing renowned local photographer Kirk Miller, who's also a friend of the station here. Helps out greatly with KRFY. So this is starting at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then at 8:30, they will be joined by Mel Dick and Brad Williams, who are organizers of the upcoming Chafe bike ride, the Chafe 150. Tune into 88.5 right at 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning for that.
And real quickly, next week at this time will be Dino Wall from the Festival at Sandpoint. And I'm going to ask her once again, what night will the Rolling Stones perform at this festival?
That's right.
This is saying goodbye from the KFY Morning Show.
Yeah, good morning out there, and goodbye, and stay tuned for Bird Note right after this.